Hello, I'm Joy Cardine with you on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 10 minutes past 8 o'clock on this Wednesday, September the 26th. Too poor to enjoy the comforts of the middle class and too wealthy to qualify for government assistance. We will talk this hour about the missing class. Some 57 million Americans with household incomes between $20,000 and $40,000 a year for a family of four. A missing class, our guest says, because no one's paying attention to this group, often trapped without a safety net and just one crisis away from falling below the poverty line. Well, we will pay attention to this group this hour as we talk with Catherine Newman, a professor of sociology and public affairs at Princeton University, who is the co-author of a new book called The Missing Class. And we will welcome your questions and thoughts about this growing segment of the population. And we'll talk specifically about some of the individuals in the missing class. And we'll also talk about whether policymakers and political parties ought to be focusing more attention on the near poor in America. 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. In Madison, 263-1890. Or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Please include your first name and your community with your email. Our guest is Catherine Newman, co-author with Victor Tan Chen of The Missing Class, Portraits of the Near Poor in America. Good morning.
Good morning.
So, you call this the missing class because it's invisible to us.
Exactly. We don't track them. We don't count them. We don't seem to know whether we have more of them or fewer of them. We pay attention to people who are below the poverty line, and properly so, but we miss out on this group entirely because they're not as troubled as those below the line, and they're not as solidly well off as those in the middle class, and so they're not on anybody's radar screen. But they are an enormous segment of the nation's population. As you said, about 53 million people fall into this category. And about 20% of the nation's children are in near-poor households, and that's a very big chunk of people altogether.
Yeah, and it's a growing segment of the population?
It has grown modestly in recent years. It took a fairly substantial jump in the late 1980s and has sort of plateaued. It goes up a bit and down a bit, but it's roughly been around 53 million for some time now.
Yeah, I think I said 57 million. I must have just had a typo there. So isn't this, though, at least some good news in that it shows that people are moving out from beneath the poverty line?
Yes, that's true. And I think one of the things that's important to recognize about this group of the near poor is that they do represent something of a success story, both in public policy terms and in their own minds, because many of them have come up from below the poverty line, taking advantage of tight labor markets in the late 1990s and opportunities for mobility that developed at that point when we had a really strong economy and relatively low inflation over that period, as well as low unemployment. So, yes, they do represent, in a sense, the promise of the nation. What they are not, however, is secure in their station. And so I think there is reason to be concerned about their future and the future of the next generation coming behind them, while at the same time recognizing that at least for this group of people, that is those who came into the missing class through upward mobility, there is some very good news here. It is, of course, possible to fall into the missing class from above, and that's a different story. But the people I wrote about in this book are mainly inner-city minorities who are very familiar with life below the poverty line and happy to see it pass them by.
Yeah. You say, though, that they're not secure. They're not stable. They're just one problem away from falling back below the poverty line?
Well, they don't have much of a safety net below them. They earn too much to qualify for any of the benefits that help to protect, however modestly, those below the poverty line. They don't have much in the way of assets. That is, they don't have much savings. They are rarely homeowners, and that is an important kind of bank account or safety net for some 68% of the nation's people, and that's not the condition that the near poor find themselves in. So they are really self-made in a sense, but that can fall apart if one earner drops out of the picture through divorce or illness or a child gets sick and someone has to be pulled from the labor force to take care of them. So they are vulnerable because they don't have the kind of cushion that many middle-class families seek and depend on to cushion themselves against the blows within the market.
Well, what is your take, your analysis on this? Does the missing class need more of a safety net?
I think they need more investment on the part of the nation in their well-being and in their mobility. I don't think they are seeking welfare benefits, for example, but I do think that they would welcome the opportunities to become homeowners, for example. I am a big believer in low-income home ownership because most Americans don't save money out of their regular paychecks until you get very high up the income spectrum. Most of us depend on the equity we realize through housing markets, and this group of people can't really do that. And they are very vulnerable to predatory lending of the kind we've seen in the subprime lending markets explode in the last 6 months or so. So they need attention in terms of lending regulations so that they aren't victimized by predatory lenders. They need the opportunity to buy decent food and cars and the other things the rest of us buy at better prices. They tend to live in neighborhoods that are not serviced by large stores, banks. They're sort of under attention. They suffer from lack of attention in the consumer markets, and that means they pay over the mark for just about everything, and they can least afford it. There are lots of other kinds of investment in education and in health protection that I think would benefit the missing class. But this is a matter of investing in the nation's future, and I think if we can help to underwrite their success, we will have cracked the problem of poverty in ways that we've never done before.
Yeah. Well, yesterday the House of Representatives voted to expand health insurance for children, a state-federal program that would provide coverage for more than 6.5 million children from families that live above the poverty level but have trouble affording private health insurance. Is that intended for the missing class?
Well, the missing class would be huge beneficiaries of the legislation, and I fervently hope that our legislators are able to override the threatened veto, because these are exactly the kids who would be blessed by such a turn of events. They are too well off, their families are too well off to qualify for Medicaid, and they work for employers that don't usually offer quality private health insurance. Some of them do have health insurance of the kind of catastrophic sort, but not the kind that provides regular preventative care, which is a far better investment to begin with. So while there are many, many other children in the nation who would benefit from this program, children in the missing class would be tremendous beneficiaries, and they really need it.
Yeah. Well, then it looks like at least the House of Representatives, the 265 who voted to expand this health insurance program, or S-CHIP, by $35 billion over the next 5 years, they're not ignoring the missing class.
No, I think it has really come to their attention that we have millions of families who've sort of followed the recipe that the country set out for them of solid attachment to the labor market. You know, they're doing the right thing, but they just don't earn enough to qualify for the kinds of private health insurance that the rest of us enjoy. And yes, I'm glad they're paying attention. It's way overdue.
Yeah. Of course, President Bush has threatened to veto that legislation. Well, you're saying, though, certainly most of the attention is not going to the missing class, and it's both Democrats and Republicans that that are ignoring the needs of this group?
This group isn't really identified as a group at all. I mean, I think I'm the first person to coin the term because, again, for lots of good reasons, we pay attention to the 34 million people who are below the poverty line, and they really are the nation's most destitute, and they deserve our attention. But this group is not defined as a social problem, and they don't make much noise. They don't demand things for themselves. They're just too busy working all the time. And yet, I think that they not only need it, but it's in our interest to provide this attention and respect for them, because they are vulnerable to falling below the line. And if that happens, either to the adults who've made this ascent or to the next generation following behind them, then we will have lost out on all the gains we made over the last decade or so in seeing people up above the poverty line.
We are talking with sociologist and author Catherine Newman. She is the co-author of the book, The Missing Class, Portraits of the Near Poor in America. And we welcome your questions at 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890, or talk at WPR.org. What should be done to invest in the missing class? We heard some of our guests' ideas. What about yours? I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. Happy to have you along. Hope you stay tuned. Coming up, it's Talk of the Nation this afternoon between 1 and 3. And after 1 on Talk of the Nation, why federal prisons are quietly removing many religious books from chapel libraries. It's an effort to keep prisons from becoming recruiting grounds for Islamic and other religious extremists. Taking religion out of prisons on Talk of the Nation this afternoon after 1. We're talking with the co-author of the new book, The Missing Class, Portraits of the Near Poor in America. The missing class, our guest says, a term that she probably coined, are the 53 million Americans, or one-fifth of the U.S. population, who are not living below the poverty level, but they are well below the middle class. They are the near poor, people with household incomes between $20,000 and $40,000 a year for a family of four. And she calls this group the missing class because they are invisible to most Americans and to the media and to policymakers and to Republican and Democrats who are running for office. We're talking about the struggles of the missing class and why it should matter to you, to all of us. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890, or send an email to talk at WPR.org. And to the phones we go. Dan in Menominee Falls is first. Hi, Dan. You're on the air.
Hi. $5.4 trillion was transferred from the producers to the non-producers during the 40 years plus of the failed liberal welfare state, and I see no good reason to restart it. I have no interest in supporting people who have had multiple generations of one family stuck in the narcotic of dependency. Sounds like a restart of what we just are trying to close down.
Yeah, hold on. You're not talking about restarting the welfare state, are you, Professor Newman?
No, I honestly don't know what your caller's talking about. These are people who are not on the welfare rolls and who do not partake of any of the federal benefits that seem to be concerning him. So we're talking about working people who often hold down two and three jobs within the household, but who don't earn enough to or don't work for employers who provide the kinds of benefits that more affluent workers receive. So I'm really talking about improving their market possibilities and their the sort of increasing regulation where it would make a difference in protecting them from predatory lenders, for example, or investing in the education that their children need, as do the rest of our children need in order to prosper in an economy that really demands highly educated people.
Dan?
My goodness. We've got all kinds of support programs for people who choose to have no interest in education. For example, if you're talking about minorities in the city of Milwaukee, in the central city, well, they consider education, that would be being too white, so they want to be kept down by their own peer group pressure not to get educated. And I should support that. Baloney.
I'm sorry. I think you're very confused about what this book is about. I mean, there is a huge literature on the question of educational motivation. That's not really what we're talking about here. The people that I'm talking about have children who are in schools that are overcrowded, underfunded, and yet they're working every hour that was ever made. And the point is not whether or not you think they're properly motivated. The point is whether or not we're going to see the next generation, their children, continue this ascent into the middle class, which is, after all, what all of us should want. I mean, that makes for a more prosperous nation, a more stable society. Surely that's what we want to see happen, and that's what will happen if we invest appropriately, as we have invested so heavily in other sectors of our population.
All right. Well, let's say Dan thinks he's taxed enough, and the missing class just has to keep on pulling itself up by the bootstraps and
Investments pay off, and if we invest properly, as we did, for example, in the GI Bill or the Social Security system, yes, those are costly investments, but look at what they achieved, and look at how much more prosperous we are as a nation for having done so. The modern middle class was built on the back of the GI Bill, which allowed a first generation ever to go to college, and that's how many of the fathers and grandfathers today ended up becoming white-collar workers. Yes, it was costly, but we reaped huge benefits from it. So we're not talking about underwriting dependency. We're talking about investing in the nation's productivity, and that, I think, has proven to be quite wise over the years.
Next, we go to Peter in Ashland. Hi, Peter.
Good morning.
Morning.
I have a question about, I guess, the idea of the hollowing out of the middle class and how you potentially see this missing class growing in the coming decades as people that came from solid middle class backgrounds, you know, hit the workforce, maybe even went to college and find themselves either making, you know, exorbitant amount of income beyond, you know, what their parents' earning potential was, or not being able to meet the earning potential of the class that they grew up in, and essentially, I guess, downward social mobility rather than upward social mobility.
Well, Peter makes a very important point, which is that we see lots of movement in the class spectrum, so to speak, both up and down. The people who appear in this book actually have moved up, and their presence in the missing class, to some degree, is good news relative to where they began. But it is true, it's absolutely true, that the other pathway into the missing class is through downward mobility. I've written about that extensively in several other books, including Falling from Grace, which is about the phenomenon of job loss and unemployment and landing at lower-level occupations, or the frustrated ambitions even of the well-educated who simply don't find jobs that will pay a middle-class income. So the missing class is populated by both kinds of people. It's populated by people who've moved up into it and people who've fallen down into it. I've been concentrating in this book on the sort of the good news story of the upwardly mobile, but you're quite right to point out that there are people coming into the missing class from the other direction, and that is a problem.
Yeah. Tell us some of the stories that you tell, because you don't just talk facts and figures. You have personal stories of people in the missing class.
That's right. Mm-hmm. This book is actually about nine different families, and I delve deeply into their lives and their stories in order to illustrate these more kind of mechanical points, if you like, or macro-level points, because I want readers to understand that there are real people here. So Let me start, for example, with one man, Mr. Linares, who was born in Puerto Rico, came to the U.S. when he was a young teenager, did not have a great teenage life, was kind of a miscreant, and by his own admission, was not a great student. Married when he was very young, divorced not long after, had two daughters with his wife before he divorced. And is not a well-educated man, and it took him time to sort of stabilize and become a real grown-up. But today he works more or less 7 days a week at two different jobs. In one job, he is a kind of caretaker for mentally disabled adults, and he helps them with basic living skills and takes care of them during the day so their families can work. The other job he has is as a hospital orderly, and in order to earn a missing class wage, meaning above the poverty line but well below the middle class, he more or less has to work 7 days a week. And he is proud of the fact that he earns a decent living. He thinks of himself as a free man, so to speak. He's not dependent on anyone. In fact, lots of other people are dependent on him. His daughters ask him for support. His mother turns to him all the time, and he willingly forks over a good deal of his earnings to help support these relatives. So he's an example of someone who, again, is receiving no support from anyone and isn't asking for it, but whose livelihood depends on holding down these two jobs more or less around the clock.
Our guest is Catherine Newman. She's a professor of sociology and public affairs at Princeton University. She's the author of many books on poverty and downward mobility and school violence, and she is the co-author of the new book, The Missing Class, Portraits of the Near Poor in America. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. Virginia in Janesville is with us now. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, I want to thank you for this book. I wish the unions would get into organizing for these people because I don't know who else can. The people themselves are working themselves to death. I have a comment and a question. The comment is there really needs to be a movement to get Whole Foods supermarkets into these neighborhoods because I had a shop at a convenience store yesterday, and it was nauseating, and the only thing I could buy was a box of crackers, and they were stale when I finally got to eat them. It's awful to think of living in a neighborhood and having to ride a bus 45 minutes and come home with two shopping bags. So I really hope something's done about that. But my question is about the health care, because there's a lot on TV that's making people angry about this bill. And the most anger-provoking thing is people with $80,000 a year are going to qualify because they keep having children irresponsibly. This is families with six kids and $80,000 a year, and normal taxpayers are going to have to pay for their health care.
So let me start with your first point, because I think it's very important. It's not just a luxury, that we should want for people to shop in elegant supermarkets. The point you made is really, really important, that there are real health consequences and therefore huge bottom-line costs to bad diets. If people live in neighborhoods where fresh fruit and vegetables are hard to acquire because the stores around them don't really carry it or don't carry decent quality food, or extremely expensive food because these are just tiny stores as opposed to the larger big box stores, then you get people who are overweight. You get children who are overweight. You get early onset of chronic diseases. And all this is very, very costly, not to mention, damaging to them. And so it's important to look at why the stores that can offer something better don't locate in these neighborhoods. And one reason, of course, is that they can be somewhat unsafe or they appear to be bad investments. But other many states have actually begun investing in pools of financing to attract larger stores that can offer better prices and higher quality in low-income neighborhoods. And I think this is an excellent idea, not only because it will provide those low-income consumers with more choices, but because it's just a huge investment in their long-range health. Mm-hmm. Now, as far as healthcare itself is concerned, I think that this bill, on the whole, is really a huge advance in the right direction. It's true that you can pick out sort of extreme cases of large families where you would still see what appears like a lot of money in terms of income, but a large number of people depending on it. But that's not going to be the norm. That's not the typical family that's going to be served here. And I do worry that we derail many important and productive, positive ideas through the illustration of extremes, which are so rare that they shouldn't really be the basis on which we endorse or withhold endorsement from a piece of legislation. The vast majority of poor families are actually small families, and they really need this coverage, as do the near poor, in order to keep them where we want them, in the labor market or their children in school, as opposed to in the hospital or spending gazillions of dollars, theirs and ours, in emergency rooms with health conditions that are very expensive to treat that way. It's just a lousy way to run the system, and no other country does it, so that should tell us something.
Virginia had another comment that I'd like your take on. She said she wished the unions would get into these neighborhoods and organize the people of the missing class.
Well, I think it's an idea that I wish would catch on. I tend to be somewhat pessimistic about this. I wish I could be more optimistic. And actually, as you know, we saw the first major strike in eons unfold yesterday with the GM workers. unions in the private sector have been shrinking before our eyes, and this has had a very profound effect on the American blue-collar worker and on income inequality more generally. The loss of that bargaining power has definitely weakened everyone at the bottom up to the middle of the income spectrum. I just don't see the revival on the horizon, and that's one of the reasons why I don't myself dwell a lot on this, even though I think it would be quite positive. I just don't see any evidence we're going in that direction. But it's at the expense of millions of American families that we don't have greater union strength. All we have to do is look across our northern border to Canada to see what a difference it makes. If you're in a missing class family in Canada, that is a family that's 100 to 200% of the poverty line, you have health insurance. You aren't living in a blasted out neighborhood. You do have decent food. You do have recreational facilities that promote exercise, which promotes health. You do have adequate transportation. You have all of these things in part because Canadians are more heavily unionized and that they can achieve more breakthroughs on behalf of those at the bottom of the spectrum.
Yeah. Virginia, thank you so much for bringing up all those points. A caller who didn't want to go on the air, wanted to remain somewhat anonymous, wants to see health and dental costs lowered for people who can't afford insurance. She says she makes barely too much to qualify for Medicaid, and recently said she received a $2,300 doctor bill to be told for 5 minutes that her husband had a heart attack.
Oh, my goodness. Mm-hmm. Poor thing. Well, you know, the healthcare system is hugely expensive, and it's partly because our insurance system as it is burdened with high administrative costs, which soak up a big part of our healthcare dollar, and it's not a terribly efficient system, which is why many people favor a single-payer system. Not everyone, of course. Some people really don't like that idea, but one of its advantages is much lower administrative costs. I getting slammed with healthcare bills of that kind is conscionable. And, I think until we see people vote on the basis of this issue, vote on the basis of which of their politicians will address these kinds of concerns and recognize the vast, huge number of missing class families who need this help, we aren't going to see the kind of action that we need. But the fact that Congress voted the way they did just yesterday tells us that those voices are stirring.
Angie in Madison is with us now. Hi, Angie.
Hi. I just had a quick comment or question. We are a family of four working on $42,000 a year, and we had sold a house before we moved here, and so we made like $25,000 and put it in savings, which is what we were told to do. But yet that makes us not qualify for things like Medicaid or WIC, which would just help a little bit with groceries and things like that. And I'm wondering, you know, do we fit into this missing class?
You are just barely outside it, but, of course, the problems that you face are very, very similar to those within it, and I'm not sure that we should consider that $2,000 more that you earn to somehow make you an entirely different kind of American. I think with any kind of definition, you're going to lose people on either end of it whose lives are really very similar, and the kinds of strains that you face certainly would be recognized by any of the people that I studied in this book.
Yeah. I think she was also saying that she was penalized for having some savings. Is there some policy changes along those lines?
Well, it's true that our, the sort of protections that we offer to those at the very bottom presume that they have no savings at all, and that would certainly be true for those below the poverty line. You know, if we really think about what it costs to maintain a family of four, $42,000 is not very much money. Mm-hmm. I mean, in the city where I did this research, in New York City, it's really not much money because our sort of rents are much higher and our cost of living is much higher. But even in the nation's heartland, in Wisconsin, it's just not very much money. And there are millions of American families who are facing these constraints. And I think I hope they will vote their interests the next time around.
Yeah, housing costs in Madison have been pretty expensive, too. George in Milwaukee, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks. This may be an argument that has to be developed just a tad, but bear with me. A couple of years ago, I believe it was Time magazine, either did a survey or reported on a survey about where Americans believe they fell in different income groups. Mm-hmm. And if my memory serves me, that about 20% of the people thought they were in the top 1% of earners, and another 20% thought that they would be someday. So what you're dealing with then potentially is 40% of the electorate who doesn't really think very kindly about social programs that are going to help people that are, you know, in the lower two-fifths of the economy.
Mm-hmm. Well, you're absolutely right that there are many mythologies of mobility in the abroad in the land, and that there is a kind of optimistic can-do spirit in the country, which is very valuable in many respects, that causes people to believe their circumstances will be bettered. But that's why we write books. We write books to draw attention to the millions of people for whom that's really not the case. And I think when we get up to numbers like 53 million, we can't really ignore this because, you know, they represent too big a fraction of the nation's population. That is not to say that I believe everyone begins with a fundamental sympathy for my point of view. But I write books about these people so that everyone will know they really exist and not assume that the more comfortable lives they lead are universally shared, because they're not.
Do you know, Professor Newman, if the missing class as a whole or a majority would tend to vote Democratic or Republican?
Well, the first question is, do they vote, period?
Yeah, yeah.
This is, you know, like the poor, it tends to be a group that isn't as active as citizens as would be desirable. I have not analyzed their voting behavior, and actually I'm not sure that one could figure it out exactly. I mean, we do know in general about the voting proclivities of people at the lower end of the spectrum. And there is a more basic sympathy, I think, for the Democratic Party, though, you know, cultural issues may cut in a different direction.
Mm-hmm.
But fundamentally, those who are lower income, especially those who are minority lower income, tend to be supporters of the Democratic Party, as they should be, given given what they need and who's paying more attention to them.
I bring this up because George's story that he relayed reminded me of those who think that there are many who vote against their own economic interests because, you know, they for whatever reason.
Well, you know, that certainly does happen, and that was the subject of What's the Matter with Kansas, a book that got a lot of attention years ago. I'm not a voting specialist.
Yeah.
I do think, though, that even people who don't share a fundamental sympathy, you know, with the poor or think that we need a new injection in the welfare state, maybe can be persuaded that good investment is actually good for all of us. That when we have taken these bold steps that Roosevelt took in the past, that, you know, the more recent versions in the Great Society took, we actually did make a difference. We really did budge some of these problems, and we really did create a modern middle class through these investments, and we've reaped the benefit ever since, and not just the people who are in those beneficiary classes, but the rest of us.
We are talking with Catherine Newman, a professor of sociology and public affairs at Princeton University, co-author of the book The Missing Class, Portraits of the Near Poor in America. You can join in with your own thoughts or questions about this growing segment of the population, 53 million people who have household incomes of between $20,000 and $40,000 a year for a family of four. They are above the poverty line, but well below middle class. 1-800-642-1234 and Madison 263-1890. Our guest calls this group the missing class because they are invisible to most of us and to most politicians and policymakers. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. Hoping you'll stay tuned. Kathleen Dunn is with you after 9 o'clock. 40 years ago, thousands of Milwaukee citizens marched for open housing. After 9, Kathleen and her guests will discuss the commemoration of that event and the still unresolved problems of social and economic inequality. Well, very related to what we are talking about right now. The 53 or so million Americans sandwiched between the poor and the middle class, who are often ignored by politicians, the media, and those who create government safety nets. The Missing Class, Portraits of the Near Poor in America, is the book that is co-authored by our guest, Catherine S. Newman. And Rod in Oregon is with us now. Hi, Rod. You're on the air.
Good morning to you.
Morning.
I would like to point out, I would rather like to complain about the people that are complaining about a welfare state. I would just like to point out that welfare comes in many forms. If you're going to a post-secondary school and you have grants and guaranteed loans, you're on welfare.
Mm-hmm. Well, I take Rod's point that, again, you know, we invest in the nation's people in many different ways, in many different guises, and in general, I think those have been good investments. They have returned to us many-fold by making people more educated, more productive, and that's what all governments do. That's what all nations do. They invest in their people in order to reap the benefits of having a more educated, healthy population. And that's what I think needs to be done for the missing class as well. I just don't want them to be forgotten about as we think more about those who are really destitute, or as politicians think, as they have to, about the proclivities and interests of the middle class who are more active voters.
Yeah. Thank you, Rod. Mary in Madison. Hi, you're on the air.
Oh, what an interesting topic. Mm-hmm. I hope you'll have this guest back. I'll be curious to see what she has to say to the situation that I've been working in for several years. I work with quite a few people that have immigrated here from other countries, often Asian countries, and also with a group of Americans that were born here, and I've been intrigued by two phenomena. One is the number of people who insist they're middle class, and I don't blame them a bit for that, when to me they so clearly are not. And I wondered if your guest could say a word or two. To me, middle class means that you have some sort of dependable income, generally a salary job, and you already own a home and a decent car, or at least you know clearly that you'll be able to soon. Now, a lot of these people are single women, and try as they might, all those things, unfortunately, are going to be utterly beyond them unless they can marry. I'm always riveted by how clearly women have to share a male's income even today, or they're simply going to be lurching from little crisis to little crisis. The other group, the people that were born in other countries, I have watched, too, with great interest, as in one generation, some of them pulled themselves up into absolutely middle class. And all I can say is, and again, I'm entirely in sympathy with both groups, that I watch them do things that most Americans simply do not want to do. They work double shifts night after night after night. They take the bus when they'd much rather get there quickly with a car. They deprive themselves in all these ways that most of us just plain don't want to do. But in a couple of years, and they're working full-time and going to school at night. On the one hand, I think it's absolutely a myth that single women in particular can pull themselves up into the same position as married women, because all it takes is one injury, one illness, the job is gone, and it's all lost.
Well, yeah, this sounds very familiar to you, Catherine Newman.
It does indeed, and you've made so many important points. First, of course, average Americans find it very difficult to see the class spectrum and locate themselves accurately as you would if you were looking at the census. So what are the things that they look at? They do look at the sorts of barometers that you were pointing to. They look at whether or not the consumption pattern seems middle class, whether they are homeowners, whether they have cars, whether they can afford to educate their kids. But increasingly, those fairly, shall we say, modest expectations require more than a middle class or middle income to afford, and most definitely require more than one income in a household to achieve. And so the middle class can be defined in many ways. It can be defined by income. It can be defined by home ownership. It can be defined by consumption standards. And all of those things have some resonance, because middle class isn't really a technical term exactly. It's kind of like a zeitgeist. It's our sense of what we ought to be. And surprisingly, many people who are much more affluent than the middle, and many people who are much poorer than the middle, still think of themselves as being in the middle. So it makes it a somewhat imprecise, actually a very imprecise term. But we do know what it is we think people ought to be able to aspire to, particularly those who are really solidly in the labor market and doing all the other things that everyone thinks they ought to do, so that they're not somehow defaulting on primary obligations. And that's why they're not doing so well. When they're doing everything that we prescribe for them and they still are struggling, or they're vulnerable, then there is a sense of trouble in the land. And I think there is a sense of trouble in the land, and which is why I hope this book, among others, will gain some traction and put words around feelings I think many people have in the country, that all is not well, that there are more people who are vulnerable than those that are just really poor. And in a sense, I think there would be more, how shall I put it, solidarity in the country, if you like, if those who are in the missing class didn't feel as though the only people who are listening out there are those who worry about the very, very poor, toward whom most of our policies are directed. Perhaps appropriately so, but that leaves out this enormous group of people and nearly more than 20% of the nation's children who are invisible to policymakers and to the rest of us most of the time.
Yeah. Got an email from a listener in Menominee, who I will also allow to remain anonymous. Excellent topic. My family of five is a member of the missing and often silent class. My husband descended into the class, and I have ascended into it. My husband works more than 60 hours a week. I work part-time. We do not advertise the fact that we are just scraping by, unable to save for retirement or our children's education. We make $400 too much each month to qualify for Wisconsin's Badger Care program, a Medicaid program, food stamps, reduced price school lunches, and much needed heat energy assistance that would add up to thousands of dollars per year. It is very stressful for my family not to have any money for clothing, entertainment, or vacations. We are one minor disaster away from a major catastrophe. I am not asking for handouts. However, when a working family can barely afford to eat and live, something needs to change.
Well, I couldn't agree with her more, and I hope she will register to vote, because only if the people who can address these issues legislatively hear voices like this and recognize that there are millions of Americans in this situation are we likely to see any action that will make a difference. I can only say that I sympathize entirely, and it's the reason why I write books like this, because I think we need to understand this is not an unusual, aberrant situation. It characterizes the lives of, again, 53 million Americans. That's a lot of people. That's, you know, there are only 300 million in the whole country, and 53 million is a large, large number of people who need need attention and need a better life and not to struggle so much.
And it's almost as though it would encourage someone in a family in the missing class to, well, you know what, maybe I won't take that second job and then I'll qualify for this program.
Well, you know, I know that many people believe that that's a motivation, but that has not been my experience in doing this kind of research. There is a very powerful sense of dignity that I think most Americans really embrace, and I would actually include most people below the poverty line here, and I've written books, several books, about the working poor as well, that is, people who are below the poverty line but work year-round and full-time, and they, too, would be better off if we were just talking about dollars, perhaps accepting what's left of the welfare system, but they don't, and why not? Well, the answer is that dignity matters to all of us, and it's a driving force, the autonomy that comes with being a functioning adult in the labor market, with being able to make your own decisions and plan your own future. That is a very high motivation indeed, and many people are willing, if you want to put it this way, to sacrifice for that autonomy some measure of material well-being that might accrue to them if they didn't. So they don't want to be part of a public assistance system. I mean, most of the people who are on public assistance don't want to be there either. But those who are above the poverty line really value their dignity and are not looking to exchange it, even at the cost of, you know, the kind of hardship that your previous caller, you know, described.
Ed in Grafton. Hi, you're on the air.
Good morning. What a great show. And just the comment that I have, your guest spoke about the Puerto Rican gentleman that worked in what seems to me to be two of the nation's gold mines, elder care, and in a hospital, and yet these employers are allowed to pay this guy such lousy money that he can't afford to live unless he works 78 hours a week. That's my comment. My other comment is the arrogance that we have in the United States about education. Not everybody's going to be educated. We need people to do labor. We need people to, you know, to clean and take care of things. These people should be allowed their dignity and their honor, and they should be paid enough. We can't say America's great when we have the term working poor. That means we don't live in a great country, and you know, and I love this country, but those are some things that I believe are intrinsically wrong with our country, and I'll take my reply off the air.
Thank you, Ed.
Well, Ed, I think you make some important points. And listening to you, I hear the echoes of a voice coming from a country which probably treats these matters rather differently. Mm-hmm. It is a very serious problem, the low level of wages paid especially to people who care for the most vulnerable in our families and in our country. And it is a source of shame, I think. It should be a source of shame that we pay them so poorly. One could say the same, not exactly the same, but a sort of related point about the nation's teachers, who we also don't pay very well, even though they are responsible for producing, you know, the flower of the nation in the next generation. I mean, there are many helping occupations that are undervalued in terms of the wages they're paid, and I don't think that helps to attract really strong people into them, and it certainly doesn't reward those who stay there and do these important forms of service for the rest of us. So I couldn't agree with you more, and I think we should ask ourselves, why is this the case? You know, why are people like this, like the gentleman from Mr. Linares from Puerto Rico, paid so poorly to take care of the most vulnerable in our society? Shouldn't we really value more strongly what he's doing to make life possible for the rest of us? I think we should.
Yeah. One more. Anne in Richland Center. Hi, you're on the air.
Boy, do I agree with the previous caller.
Mm-hmm.
I work in low-level health care, and man, oh man, you're paid very poorly, and it's just it's an awfully hard job. But anyway, my comment is this. You know, probably 20 or 30 years ago, education was affordable to the middle class. And now, I'm sorry, it's priced way beyond their means. And I mean, yeah, people can get grants and so forth if they're an unwed mother or a single parent or so on. But even so, it's such a grind to go to school, plus support a family or even support yourself. I'm doing it right now. I had an education in previous years, but I've lost everything, being a homemaker and now divorced. It's just really tough. I don't know how people can possibly pay for it.
Yeah, and we have less than a minute, Professor Newman.
Well, all I can say is I completely agree with you. The educational affordability is a serious issue. Many states have been retrenching and pulling back on the contributions they make to public higher education, and that's forced the universities to raise tuition in ways that make it very hard to afford, and yet very critical, because even though I agree with Ed that we should accord dignity and higher wages to uneducated workers who work with their hands, the fact of the matter is the tide of the economy is shifting sharply in the direction of those with more education, and unless we make it possible for people to get that education, they will sink in terms of their wages, and this would be a tragedy. It is a tragedy for all of us.
Well, Catherine Newman, let me agree with most of our callers and say this was a great program. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much.
Catherine Newman, co-author of The Missing Class, Portraits of the Near Poor in America.